This morning we begin our study of the epistle to the Romans, and that is a book that I've been wanting to preach for some time. I was telling Ryan this morning before the service started that I've been wanting to teach this book since we were in England, but never got the chance to do it. And so for me, this is just a thrill to finally get to it and be able to look at it more in depth. Because really, out of all the books of the Bible, none has had a more personal or historical impact on the world than the book of Romans. There is no hyperbole when I say that this book has literally turned the world upside down. That is true. That is true in your personal life. That is true in the course of world history. Stories are often told of the conversions of St. Augustine and Martin Luther. Augustine was a man who lived in the 4th century. He was an immoral man who, by his own admission, was enslaved to his lusts. As professor of rhetoric, Augustine was at the height of his career in academia in the city of Carthage. But one day, in the late summer of AD 386, at 31 years of age, Augustine went to visit a friend, a good friend of his named Alypius, in Milan, Italy. And as they sat in the garden, Augustine began to weep. And he was weeping in great conviction over the sin of his life. His agony over his inability was really over his inability to break with his sin. And at one point, his weeping was so great that he had to excuse himself from the presence of his friend. And so, finding a nice quiet place in the garden, which he could be alone, he threw himself to the ground and cried out to God and said, "How long, O Lord? How long wilt thou be angry with me forever?" And then while he was sitting there in his misery, he heard the voice of a child singing, "Tole lege, tole lege," which means take it and read it, take it and read it. And he sifted through his mind to recall the words of a child's song that would have those words in it, and found none. And thinking this to be a sign from God, Augustine went back to his good friend Alypius and picked up the scroll that lay at his feet. Determining to read the first verse his eyes sat upon, Augustine happened upon Romans 13:13, which says, "Let us behave properly as in the day, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual promiscuity and sensuality, not in strife and jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regards to its lusts." Augustine says, "I had no wish to read further, for there was no need. For immediately as I reached the end of this sentence, it was as though my heart filled with a light of confidence, and all the shadows of my doubt were swept away." Those words mark the conversion of Saint Augustine. Augustine had plenty to learn in terms of working out a proper biblical theology, but he would spend the rest of his life from that point on perfecting it. And for the next 1,100 years of church history, he would become one of the most influential men of the church. All that because of Romans. All that because of those two verses, Romans 13:13 and 14. So then we fast forward another 1,100 years, and we find ourselves in an Augustinian monastery in Germany to a monk by the name of Martin Luther. Much different from the licentious life of Augustine, Luther was a very serious soul. He was quite religious by external standards, very pious, very, very earnest. He wanted to please God. He tried to please God. He did all that monks do and more to please God. But like Augustine, he found no rest for his soul. And the more he worked for his salvation, the more his salvation seemed to elude him. Luther's problems all hinged on a phrase from Romans chapter 1, verse 17. That phrase being the righteousness of God. Luther understood that phrase as to be a reference to the righteousness whereby God punishes sinners. To him, it spoke of judgment. It spoke of God's justice. And Luther, as good as he was, found no relief. All he found was condemnation. Luther said, "I raged with a fierce and troubled conscience. I beat importunately upon Paul at that place in Romans, most ardently desiring to know what St. Paul wanted." See, he thought God was demanding a standard of perfection that was unattainable to him. And the turmoil was so bad for Luther that Luther said he started to hate God. He said, I quote, "I had no love for that holy and just God who punishes sinners. I was filled with secret anger against him. I hated him because, not content with frightening by the law and the miseries of us of life, us wretched sinners already ruined by original sin, he still further increased our tortures by the gospel." Luther understood the gospel to be setting forth another standard, and because he couldn't meet that standard, he couldn't attain to it, he was left wanting. But one day in 1518, while studying Romans chapter 1, verse 17, Luther recalls, "At last, by the mercy of God, meditating day and night, I gave heed to the context of those words. Namely, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just, the righteous, shall live by faith." He says, there I began to understand that the righteousness of God is that by which the righteous lives, the righteous lives by a gift of grace, namely by faith. And I felt that I was altogether born again and entered paradise itself through open gates. At that moment, Luther realized that what he needed was a righteousness from God. Not his own righteousness, not something to attain to, but something that was given. He needed God's righteousness given freely to anyone who would receive. It was a righteousness received by faith, faith alone. Faith taking what God freely gives and offering nothing in return. Faith simply means taking God at his word, believing him. And this is what Luther did, of which he says, he felt himself to be born again. And thus began the Protestant Reformation. All of that from this one verse in Romans. Indeed, the book of Romans has been one of the most influential books of human history from the first century on, because in it, the gospel of God is unveiled in its clearest form. As Paul said, chapter 1, verse 16, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes." Beloved, the gospel transforms lives. It unleashes the power of God for salvation. And when that happens, there is no stopping the amount of damage it will do to the kingdom of darkness. It takes a sin-bound, immoral person like St. Augustine and frees him. It takes a religious-bound, righteous man like Luther and frees him too. It makes him a slave of grace. It makes St. Augustine a slave of righteousness. Luther said of Romans, it is the purest gospel. 17th century English Puritan Thomas Drake said that Romans was the quintessence and perfection of saving doctrine. It is the gospel in its clearest form, its clearest presentation. This is the book that we have before us and we'll study for the next, I don't know, little while of the church. Next 5 years, maybe so. But I promise you, like all of God's word, it will be tremendous. It will bless our church. It'll bless our community. It'll bless your soul. It'll change your life like never before. In the book of Romans, we're going to learn about God's plan of salvation, how a person can be made right with God. We'll look at the universal guilt of mankind, both the religious man and the pagan who's in the bush in Africa somewhere. You know, the guy that's never heard the gospel. What about him? We're going to learn about victory over sin. How is sin's power in my life defeated? How do I respond practically? We'll learn about the place of God's law in our lives. We'll learn about the work of the Holy Spirit in our lives. We'll learn about the eternal security of the believer and his or her perseverance. We'll learn about the future plan of God for Israel. A Christian's response to government. A Christian's response to liberty. All these things we're going to study and learn from the book of Romans. All these things are addressed to one degree or another. So now, just for this morning, we're going to introduce the book and just kind of give you a basic understanding of the book, and then I want to give you something to take home for a future study. We notice there in just the obvious there in verse 1 that it was written by the Apostle Paul. And we notice, too, that it was written, verse 7, to all who are beloved of God in Rome. Paul, to all who are beloved of God in Rome. Now, we're going to talk more about Paul next week when we begin chapter 1. But for now, we note that Paul had never been to Rome before penning this letter. We saw that in our scripture reading. Notice his comments beginning in verse 9. For God, whom I serve in the spirit of the preaching of the gospel of his Son, is my witness as to how unceasingly I make mention of you, always in my prayers, making requests if perhaps now, at last, by the will of God, I may succeed in coming to you. For I long to see you in order that you may be established, that is, that I may be encouraged, each of us by the other's faith, both yours and mine. And I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that often I have planned to come to you, but have been prevented thus far. He had never been there, nor had he had fellowship with the believers there. And yet he was desirous of ministering to them. And yet when you flip over to chapter 16, you flip over there. At the end of the book, even though Paul had never been there, we find that Paul actually knew quite a few people who were there. Prisca and Aquila in verse 3. Epaphras, verse 5. Mary, verse 6. Andronicus, verse 7. Ampliatus, Urbanus, Apelles, Aristobulus, Herodian, Narcissus. I'll bet that was a one-sided relationship. Paul knew quite a few people, even though he'd never visited there. And so the question arises, how did the Roman church get started? And this is no end of debate over this. Roman Catholic Church says that the Church of Rome was founded by Peter. The Catalogus Liberianus, dated AD 354, designates Peter as the founder and first bishop of the Church of Rome. The support they offered for this is Acts chapter 12. Acts chapter 12, remember, Acts 12 records the martyrdom of the Apostle James by Herod Agrippa I. Having public support for the death of James, Herod then proceeded to arrest Peter as well. And you remember that's when Peter was in prison, and then the angel comes and appears to him to break him out of prison. And so he breaks him out, and then he goes to this house where all the believers are gathered praying for his release, and he knocks on the door, and the servant girl comes to the door. She opens it. She recognizes that it's Peter's voice, remember, and she's so happy, she can't believe it, that she runs to tell the others, and she leaves Peter standing outside. But when she tells the rest of the group, what does the group do? They say, you're out of your mind. They've been praying for his release. God releases him. The little girl says he's here, and they say, you're crazy. So Peter keeps knocking until they let him in. But we notice that it says in verse 17, but motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had let him out of prison. And he said, report these things to James and the brethren. And he departed and went to another place. It's that last line that the Catholic Church uses to support Paul's travel to Rome for the founding of the church. They say by going to another place, he went to Rome, spent the next 25 years establishing it. Now, by the end of Acts chapter 12, obviously Herod Agrippa dies, and so that would date this around 44 AD. Seems to me that's way too early for Peter to be in Rome. There's little evidence in the early church to confirm that he was there at this time. Weight of evidence goes against it in the late second century, much earlier than the Catalogus Liberianus. Irenaeus claimed that both Peter and Paul founded the church in Rome. And that is just a ridiculous claim. But it makes the point that early church was somewhat off on this. Another argument against Peter's founding the Church of Rome is found in Romans 15. If you turn to Romans 15, we get a glimpse into Paul's personal philosophy of ministry. In Romans 15, verse 20, he says, "Thus I aspired to preach the gospel, not where Christ was already named, that I might not build a man upon another man's foundation, but as it is written, they who had no news of him shall see, and they who have not heard shall understand." If Peter had been to Rome and founded the church, then Paul's desired visit to them would have been a contradiction of his approach to ministry. Paul was not in the business of building upon another man's foundation. He was in the business of planning his own churches and seeing them to fruition. So we reject the notion that Peter founded the church in Rome, primarily on the reference to Romans chapter 15, verse 20. This would not have been Paul's method of evangelization and growing the church. But that still leaves us with a question. If Peter didn't do it, then how did the Church of Rome get founded? Well, a second answer is given. Ambrosiuster of the late 4th century identifies the Jewish synagogue as the starting place of Christianity in Rome. This is the second view of how the Church of Rome began. Now, we think there might be some merit to this, to these ideas brought forth, but we don't eat the whole enchilada of this one either. If you go back to Acts chapter 2 for a moment, Acts chapter 2, remember, this is the day of Pentecost, and we note that on the day of Pentecost, there were men who were from Rome that were visiting Jerusalem when the apostles began to speak in tongues, starting in verse 8. "And how is it that we hear each of them in our own language to which we were born, Parthians and Medes and Elamites and residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt and the district of Libya around Cyrene, and visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes?" Now, if some of those men who were in Rome at that, or who were in Jerusalem at that time, if they were part of the 3,000 that got saved, it seems plausible, though not stated, that they would return to Rome. And the most natural place of worship for early Jewish Christians in the Roman Empire would have been what? Synagogue. Right? In fact, Paul, on his missionary journeys, you know, when he would target the synagogue. He would go there and he'd remain there until they kicked him out. And when they did, he usually took a number of the Jews or the God-fearing Gentiles with him. Now, by the end of the first century B.C., okay, this is B.C. now, there were many Jews who had migrated to Rome. So there was a thriving synagogue system there. But the synagogues were only loosely connected. They were, you know, they were independent Jews, I guess you'd say. All right, they weren't connected to each other in a formal setting. So you could go into a synagogue and worship and kind of slip under the radar, and that would be okay. So the idea here is that a few Jews from Rome came to Pentecost. They got saved, they returned to Rome, and they assimilated into their own local synagogues, taking Christ with them. The impact of all that would leave a predominantly Jewish church. Right, growing out of the synagogues, right, there would be some Gentiles there for sure, but the majority of those coming out would be Jews. Now that is all very plausible, very possible. But one of the problems with this view is that when Paul writes to them, he seems to be addressing a predominantly Gentile audience. Now those who hold this view look to get around this by an event that happens in the reign of Claudius. Turn to Acts chapter 18 real quick. Acts chapter 18, verses 1 and 2 gives the New Testament account. After these things, he left Athens and went to Corinth, and he found a certain Jew named Aquila, native of Pontus, having recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. And so he came to them. Now, the expulsion of the Jews happened somewhere around AD 49. Roman historian Suetonius claimed that Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome because they were constantly rioting at the instigation of Crestus. The Latin, in Latin, the E and the I were often confused when translating from the Greek. So in the Greek, the word Crestus could be Christos, in other words, Christ. And most scholars agree that Crestus is a corruption of the word Christos. In other words, the rioting within the Jewish community in Rome was over the claim that Jesus was the Christ, the Messiah. So Claudius kicked them all out. He didn't want the rioting. So with all the Jews leaving the city, the church remaining would naturally be Gentile. That's all that's left. And this would leave the Gentile element in the church pretty much to themselves for organization, which would last until AD 54 at the death of Claudius. When that happened, the Jews were allowed to return. The only difference now is now with the Jews returning, it was the Gentile contingency in the church that was the established contingency. They were the main rulers, if you will. That's a bad way to phrase to use it. But they were the ones operating the church in Rome. By the way, if you take that view, that helps to explain some of the things in the book of Romans where you see these tensions between the Jews and the Gentiles. But there's one drawback to that view. If it's the case that the Jews from Pentecost went back to Rome to found the church, then how do we explain Romans 16 and all the people that Paul addresses by name? I mean, out of all the letters of Paul, this letter has the most people mentioned by names. He seems to know everybody. And not just as acquaintances, but as people that he knew well, people that he worked with, people that he co-labored in gospel ministry with. So we offer a third view for the founding of the Church of Rome. It wasn't Peter. It wasn't the Jews from Pentecost. Instead, it was founded by people whom Paul had converted on his missionary journeys and who had consequently moved to Rome and took the gospel with them. I mean, Rome was the center of the civilized world. There was constant traffic in and out of Rome. People were always relocating to Rome. In fact, in three of the cities Paul ministered, there was constant communication with Rome. Right? Philippi was a military town. And the people, the military people were moving from Rome to Philippi back and forth. Right? Remember when he writes when he writes Philippians, he's in Rome now in jail, and he says, you know, those who are beloved of God greet you, especially those of Caesar's household. These were the people in Rome. So there was constant movement there, constant communication between Paul and people within Rome. This would explain for how Paul could know and address so many people personally in chapter 16. Now, as the possibility of Jews having been saved at Pentecost is possible. And if so, they surely would have assimilated back into the synagogue system. And it would have been only after the late 40s that Paul's converts began to arrive at Rome. And when they would have arrived, they would have been trained by Paul regarding ministry and church organization. So if there were Jewish Christians then in Rome at that time, they probably would have reorganized, not under the synagogue, they would have left that and have reorganized under new Christian settings, especially after the return of the Jews from Claudius. All that helps to explain the number of contacts that Paul has in Rome that he mentions by name. And that also explains the letter's depiction of Gentile dominance throughout the church in Rome. It explains Paul's interaction with both Jewish and Gentile contingencies within the church. It explains how Paul could take the tone that he does in the letter and address them on matters of fundamental importance like the gospel. I mean, according to Paul, Romans 15, verse 20, he's not going to build a man upon another man's foundation, and yet the letter of Romans is all about the gospel. With his own people going there and doing ministry work, he would certainly be at liberty to share the gospel with the people of Rome, those whom he had trained to take the gospel and minister in his place. Now, Paul wrote Romans somewhere around the end of AD 56. As he is completing his third missionary journey, he stayed in Corinth before departing for Jerusalem. Remember, Paul had been collecting money for the Jerusalem saints, and this was just more than an offering for the poor. It was, in fact, a collection taken up from Gentile churches, right, sent to minister to the needs of the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem. This was an important gift. There was a huge tension between Jewish Christianity and Gentile Christianity in the first century. And the offering was not just for the poor, it was a goodwill gift to smooth over those tensions. You can see those tensions underline numbers of New Testament letters, Ephesians, Philippians, Corinthians, Galatians, Titus, and here in the book of Romans. In the book of Acts, Luke says that Paul stayed 3 months in Greece before taking the gift to Jerusalem. Turn to Acts chapter 20, verse 3. And there he spent 3 months in Greece. And when a plot was formed against him by the Jews, as he was about to set sail for Syria, he determined to return through Macedonia, and he was accompanied by Sopater of Berea, and Phirrus, and Aristarchus, and Secundus of the Thessalonians, and Gaius of Derbe, and Timothy, and Tychicus. But these had gone on ahead and were waiting for him at Troas. We sailed from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and then we came to Troas within 5 days. It was there, in this three-month stay in Greece, before taking his trip with this money back to Jerusalem, it was there in Corinth that he wrote Galatians. It was here in Corinth that he would write the letter to the Romans. That Paul was in Corinth while he was in Greece makes sense. Corinth was the main hub of the Achaean Peninsula. In Romans chapter 16, you just flip back there real quick. In Romans chapter 16, we notice in verse 1 and 2, or in verse 1, that he commends our sister Phoebe, who is a servant of the church which is at Cenchrea. Cenchrea was a seaport adjacent to Corinth. We also have in verse 23, a mention of Gaius. This is probably the same Gaius whom Paul baptized in Corinth, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 14. So every indication is that Paul wrote from Corinth before traveling to Jerusalem with the gift of the saints, and then on to Rome. Now, why did Paul write Romans? Well, there seems to be a number of converging reasons for the writing of the letter. Judging from the contents of the book, there seems to be a pretty definite, almost systematic presentation of the gospel chapters 1 through 8. And within that pretty tightly sustained argument, Paul addresses here a number of things specifically related to Jews.